Hello and welcome back to another episode of the DOB podcast. Today we have with us Meenakshi and Siddell. They both started their journeys as industrial designers and now work as UX researchers. So let's start by getting to know you guys better. How about you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Meenakshi. I work at Microsoft India as a UX researcher. I work as a part of their creative studio in India called Studio 91. And I work primarily on this app called Microsoft Office app, which combines Word, PowerPoint, Excel, PDF, and many other file formats and tools into one product, which is trying to be a space where you come to for all kinds of work files. So recently I have been working a lot with the design team. We're trying to ship a lot of features. So we do research to evaluate which features to choose, which form it should take, and what works and what doesn't work, so that we're shipping meaningful features and updates to people who are already using the application. But apart from that, I also tend to work on more discovery kind of research, where you're trying to understand how do people work across the world in different contexts and different cultures? How do people use a certain file type, for instance, or how are they storing their files? How are they using different devices as a part of their work? And then I hone in on and understand how people use their mobile devices in particular, because that helps the mobile app the most. But before this, I used to work as an independent researcher, collaborate with research agencies, to startups, to help them understand what research is, as well as, you know, collaborate with them to do research for them that's tailored for their size of business or what they can do with the resources that they have available at that point. And before that, I used to work with Siddell at Swiggy, and we were a part of a research team that researched across their consumer platform, their restaurant platforms, and understand how people are ordering their food. And that was also a very interesting experience. That was more physical research. Right now, it's completely remote. So I'm talking to people across the world, but sitting in my house on the table all the time. So that's how it's been going so far. Yeah, I think that's a quick recap of what I've been up to lately and in the recent past. I think I'll give Siddell a chance.
So in this description, I'm going to be a little bit more like descriptive about myself, because there are people who listen to podcasts because that's the only source of content that they can consume due to some sort of temporary or permanent disability. So let's give this a shot. So my name is Siddell. My pronouns are she and her. I am a brown female with like straight black hair. And I currently am in my study room in Bangalore, India, with a bookshelf right behind me because I love reading, and I'm wearing some casual clothes right now and sipping some juice because it's really humid here. So that's just a visual description of those who really can't really visualize who I am right now. But apart from that, what I do is I work for the document cloud team in Adobe, which is products like Adobe Reader and the paid version, which do use for PDFs. So you also have Adobe Sign and Adobe Scan, a lot to do with document usage, document productivity. And my work has primarily been understanding document use cases, how individuals like students or people like us use documents, and even people like, say, small and medium-sized businesses or enterprises use documents on their day-to-day basis to complete some sort of task. And this has become even more post-COVID because everything's gone remote and there is no physical document that you're signing or physical document that you're consuming. Everything's happening online. And the use of usage of these tools have increased a lot more. So the teams I collaborate with are people working on large screen devices, that is desktop and web browsers, for the same products that I told you. And I collaborate a lot with design, with product managers, engineers on different phases of research. So currently I'm trying to learn a lot about document manipulation or editing use cases. So I'm in the discovery phase that Meenakshi spoke about, where I'm trying to see how people edit documents, why are they editing documents in the first place, what are the different tools they use, what are the do they use Acrobat for it, do they go to any other tool for it, and so on and so forth, in the hope that we can make editing better in the near future. So that's what I'm doing currently. Now, if I have to go back to why I'm in this user research space, I never planned to be a researcher. I was an industrial design student like all of us over here. But I think research really, like while doing those projects, I think research really pulled me. And I think I really love the process of understanding user behavior. So I got into research through an internship in Bangalore. In an agency, I decided to not pursue my degree and instead join the world of research. I received the role of a user research intern in an agency for focus on more qualitative research, where you're understanding why are users behaving this way, you're observing what they're doing instead of just sending in surveys or, you know, getting just what they are doing. We're trying to go a little bit more deeper. And this is mostly in the tech field. I've never worked anywhere outside tech. So most of the products have been something that you use on phones or on desktop or anything to do with tech. After that, I worked for Swiggy. Swiggy is an organization that we all know for food delivery in India. And I studied a lot about how consumers order food or what is the process of ordering food, as well as we looked, like Meenakshi, we work on the project together where we looked into restaurants and their ecosystem, and you know, how does these delivery apps play a part in the restaurant ecosystem. So that's what I studied a lot when I was in
what you do that I'm doing. That's a short description of what you do. A 4-year-old. Yeah, I think honestly, even as like this has always been a thing where we have to explain what we do to many people. It happens. It's a question we answer all the time. I think what I would do is first of all show them the product that I am working on, because they might not have context of what happens in a workspace and how people interact with each other. So show them that, maybe tell them that there are, say, millions of people who have the same thing on their phones and they're using this to get their work done. What I try to do is learn how they go about doing that and see if there are some problems that they're facing, if there is something that is missing in this, there is something more that can add value to how they're using this tool and trying to get their work done. And then try to bring this information back so that we can make these improvements and make the whole experience meaningful. Yeah, I think that would be one way to describe it. But I think if there was anyone a little bit more inclined to know, I think one part I would also include is that it's also so that you can help your company deliver good experiences so that they have a good business. Very often that is something that's a forgotten aspect of why we do what we do. But it is equally important that there are good experiences that lead to good business. So, yeah, sometimes you need to make some hard choices there. But, yeah, our overall goal is to keep people in mind when we're building things for them.
Yeah, I think this question was great. Really got me thinking of, how will I tell my grandmom? Like, my mom doesn't understand yet what I'm doing. So now I have to go one level up. So what I would personally do is try to connect it to a story. Like, we all, like researchers being storytellers, I'm going to try and make up a story now for my grandmom. So one thing that I would do with tell her was, like, you know, just imagine that me and my brother, who are our grandchildren, would come to your house for vacation. And, you know, she would give us a call beforehand. She'd be like, what do you want to eat? And what do I prepare for you today? And she would ask us what we want. And by the time we land there, she would, like, make all these fancy food that we asked her to prepare. And but being this awesome grandma and this caretaking person that she is, she would also prepare meals that she thinks it's healthy for us because we are not eating it. So she would have, like, these vegetables and these fruits that she would keep on serving us, which is good for our nourishment. And while she's preparing these new dishes, she would keep observing, you know, what we liked, what we didn't like, you know, what did we find spicy, or what did we find just right, or she'll ask us if she found some, you know, if we didn't like the food. And she would observe our habits, observe us, because she's always working towards, I'll tell her, you're always working towards, you know, giving us this enjoyable experience, this lovely experience, and you want us to keep visiting you again and be the coolest grandparent, the favorite grandparent ever. So all this, I'm going to tie this up and be like, you know, my story is not that different. My job is very similar, like how you try to meet the needs of your grandchildren, we too try to meet the needs of like millions of users. And like you, I work on providing the best experience for people using this application that I'm showing you right now. And these are people who might just use documents for like signing, these might use documents for just reading and anything. And my responsibilities are very similar to what you did just now. You know, I'll either, you know, call them for an interview and ask them like, you know, what do they want? Like what are their needs? What do they require before we actually go and prepare something? Or else we'll make something, we'll create something and go back to them and be like, you know, okay, now tell me, like, does this actually fit your needs? Do you still like it? Do you not like it? Not directly, do you like it? But yeah, that's what do you like it? How are you feeling? Try to understand their feedback. And the goal is the same, right? The goal is I want to give them a good experience so that they keep coming back to our product, keep using our product. So that's what a user researcher does, really. Just like you and yeah,
Yeah,
aunt,
that's
luckily we
really
have
nice.
grandmas and user researchers in this world.
Yeah, I love that. I'm using that next time. I'm gonna steal this.
Steal it.
My question is, I guess, two part. First of all, of course, like, how does the industrial design, you know, the industrial design education that both of y'all have had informs the research? Of course, that completely brings quality to the type of research you do, as opposed to somebody who's from the very get-go had an education in research and then joins a company. So you already bring a lot of value, and I'm curious to understand what do you think that factor is, because we assume that the research that we do is enough to inform, like, you know, the product that we are making. We have secondary research that has been done by, you know, scientists. We have so much by engineers. We can Google. There is so much content out there. But even then, Adobe, Microsoft, these brands, they invest in design researchers, and they have a person who specializes in it. So what is it that industrial designers would not be able to bring to the table for a brand that design researchers bring to a brand?
This is quite interesting because I feel like even the industry has asked this question in the past when research was not really a mainstream profession or it didn't have a very clear career trajectory. And the same thing was done to design before that. So say if you think back at when you were in design school, when we were in design school, or even earlier than that, it seemed like, you know, oh, why do you need to design apps all the time? And it's just screens and it's words and pictures. What's there to it? You know, that kind of mindset and why value design has been a question in many industries at many points of time. And same thing happens with research as well. So I think let's try and answer what you were saying about education, right? Like, how does having a design specific education versus having a research specific education affect how you perform in the industry? I feel like having had a design specific education and then switching to research, I have seen that it helps to have a different context because you're coming in with a different perspective. And I've seen the same thing reflect with people who have come from a totally different background. So it's design to research. Someone's come from marketing to research. Someone's come from journalism to research. And each person brings a certain point of view, understanding of context, understanding of culture, languages that they speak. So much makes you a talented researcher and not just your education. So that's when you draw from your previous experience, when you draw from your education, is when you can see these different styles of research. There are a lot of academic researchers who go into research in companies which is more hands-on and it's short-term, short cycles, that kind of research. And you can tell that they come with a loaded knowledge of how to carry out research at large scales, how to analyze data.
Yeah.
But there's also people like us who've come from design, where we speak the language of design and we understand about proportion, balance, contrast, flows, how people must be thinking logically. We're thinking about it in a totally different sense, and that in itself adds value. And that's why you will see when companies are talking about hiring diversity, it's not just diverse people from diverse cultures, it's diverse people from diverse backgrounds as well, and that includes education. But this is not to discount someone who is coming from a research education to a research field. Of course, that's a huge advantage in itself. You've already done a lot of the learning.
Yeah.
But what once they're in the industry, they also build a different point of view based on the kind of products that they've worked on. Maybe they've worked in agencies where they're doing different types of projects. They're working with NGOs. They're working on things like sustainability. Maybe they're also understanding finances, financial technology, education. So that's what builds your knowledge as you go. So education is the first step that broadens your minds, and you start exploring how you are, how you, what your skills are, what your interests are, and your profession and your career trajectory is what takes that and puts that to use. And that could come from anywhere, to be honest. And you've seen that with design as well. Mm. And I think same thing follows with research.
Because the skills that you require to break into the field is just about relating and empathizing with human beings. That's your basic crux of user research. And like what Meenakshi said, we have people from different backgrounds. And their background just makes them easier to work with, say, a larger audience. Like if someone comes from a research background, they might know cognitive behavior, they might know anthropology much more better than what me and Meenakshi would have ever known in the past. But because of our design background, we can speak to our design stakeholders in a very smooth communicative language where we understand what they are trying to convey to us because we know the basic principles of design. Same thing if someone comes from engineering to research, then for them talking to an engineering stakeholder during the development of the or the launching of the product would be far more better. So I even have people from photography background who are researchers right now. And for them, it's like just that act of being immersed in the context and taking pictures of different cultures, different people, that brings out the research and empathy factor in them. And that's the beauty about research. It's new and it allows people from different contexts to join in. The question about can designers do research as well? To answer that, yes, we can. And it's good to know it. A designer could do research. It's great if they know it because sometimes you might not have a researcher in your team. Sometimes you may have a researcher, but they might not have the bandwidth for the job that you have. And let's say your task, your research ask is very small. Let's say it's just testing your product. Then maybe you can go ahead and do the research. That's where it's very important for you to know how to do research and how do you, you know, what tools you can use and, you know, how do you get the people and what is the right way of speaking to these people. That's very important. But what we have seen is that when you are so invested as a designer in your own product, which you're building for years and years and years, if you're in a tech company, you're building it for years. So you can miss out on those tiny things, or you might not take criticism in the right way. It makes you also biased towards your product. So you might just look at some aspects in the design which you feel are not correct and not look at it from a larger perspective when you're talking to the users. So it's great if a designer knows research. Also, it's like you can't do all forms of research for your designs because you are not an expert in that. And you may have a certain level of bias, which maybe me or someone else who's a researcher coming into the team, I'm not linked to your design. I'm not attached to it. I have not been sitting and working on it. I can go ahead, talk to users, come back and thrash it. I have no emotional quotient with it. So, and that's the good things about research. They can come back and they are called the bad news there or something. You just come with like, this is not working. So that's why I feel that it's a good skill, but I don't think that you should do it like to an extent that you're doing design and research on equal levels, because it's not going to help your design. It's not going to impact you, because you might have to have biases and you might not cover the entire spectrum of research.
Suppose you're a designer who researches and codes, but can you imagine how thin you're stretching yourself to do both of these things and doing justice to every single thing? Why are companies like Google, Adobe, Microsoft, all of them hiring specific researchers to do it? It's to have these advocates for users who are unbiased, but also to have people do what they specialize in to make sure that when they're all together, they're able to collaborate and build something that's really innovative, that's really meaningful. And it has proven to work, and then it becomes a pattern where more companies start considering hiring specialists in certain areas and expanding what they can do, but having specific people who do specific things.
And go ahead. No, it's true. I mean, even in tech, if you see, there can't be one person solving for everything. We are a team. We collaborate together. Actually, we complement each other. Like design complements research complements a product. A lot of people work hand in hand to let that product be successful. It's not a one person game at all. That was the ideology we were in college, and that was a big bubble that got bursted when you entered the industry. Mm-hmm. This is not the way things are going to work, and you're not going to be this one-man army at all. And the beauty of that is that even though there are these, you know, there are times when you have problems, there are times when there are no alignments, but the thing is that at the end of it, the team needs to come together. There is someone acting like, you know, let's get this work done. Let's be on the same page. You know, there are some experts working on it. And you get to feed off and learn other, what does an engineer do? Or you get to learn how the design is solving this approach. You understand how PM, product managers work. So that is the beauty of being in a team. If you're a solo driver, you're not going to learn and you're not going to grow. You're going to be in this bubble that whatever you know is enough. That's what was the thing in college, that our awareness did not grow after a particular point, because we knew only this much, like the size of a like a size of a seed. And when we entered the industry, we realized that it's huge, and we're not even aware about these things. So I think growing that awareness is very important, and learning that, you know, the bigger picture out there has many people, there are systems working on it, and there are experts working on this, from whom I can speak to, I can learn, and I can be a part.
We have to do it all, and we have to be good at everything, and that's how it has to be. But this was a realization for me as well after graduation, when I stepped out into the industry, that it matters so much to be specialized on a certain subject. It just helps you so much to be better at what you do. But since you're speaking of collaborating with different teams and different profiles, it reminds me of something Pratyush was saying earlier. How does it work when, as a researcher, you have to work with designers? Do they sometimes have resistance towards what you present to them? Because then you become those people who are like setting constraints or...
There's this tussle between engineers who say that, what are these designers doing? And then the industrial designers are like, they never game for, like, you know, new solutions. But like, so is the role of a design researcher like to be kind of the voice of reason for the designer? And be like, listen, you're going a little off, you know, off the track? Or is it research and bring out information that, I guess, helps them, you know, create that crazy idea? Because when both of us, Kamaljeet and I, when we research, we always try to, we always come up with ideas and then try to supplement it using the research that we're doing. But I don't think that's how it works in companies. Like, that's what our question is. Do the industrial designers work off of the research, or the researchers try to supplement the designer, industrial or any UI UX designer?
Let's address the tussle question very quickly. In my experience so far, to be honest, design has been the biggest ally to research, where I feel the profession of design, you're constantly thinking about how people use stuff. That question is constantly in your mind. When you're creating a new design, of course, you're thinking about how you could innovate, but you're also thinking about problem solving and usability and things like that. And that naturally puts a lot of designers in the space of, you know what, I want to learn more, or I am using this application and it's difficult for me. So I can only imagine how it is for other people. So they already have this inclination to be empathetic, to try and understand how people are using things in the real world. And they understand that if they know this, if they're armed with this tool, they can create things that are even more innovative, because they can't just innovate in a silo and then put things out in the world and expect them to work, which is how we used to function in design school, purely because nothing was out there in the world at that point. But in this space, that's what matters eventually. The whole team is working towards that goal. So I think in the professional setup, I've seen people being more aware of what research can offer, and therefore being more open to it, especially design, because of the nature of the job. And that's why so many times you partner with design to try and put the user voice forward and try and prove through design that research can bring impact. So very often, like, this is a project that Sidel and I have also done, where we've really just partnered with design to, you know, visualize the things that people are trying to say, go back with the new designs, get more feedback, improve it, and then seen that this work, once it's shipped, just work. Why? Because you've already taken people's voice into consideration, and design and research have done that together. So as opposed to what it might seem like, this is often what happens because of the nature of these jobs. But like Sidel had mentioned, there's so many collaborators involved in this process of putting a product together, especially in digital products, that, like, when they're all working towards the same goal, they have that understanding that, okay, you know what, I understand that, you know, I want to be a designer who can just solve problems, but whose problems, what problems, how am I going to know about that? Research. So Now that companies are hiring researchers, they have this tool at hand, they're seeing this tool being applied, it proves it more and more for them that it has value. And then they try and then you see people come to you saying that, listen, I have this question. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Or we have these two options in design. We have no idea which way to go because there's nothing that's making us lean one way or the other, you know, things like that. So that's how the culture builds. That's how you collaborate and partner with different functions. And I know it sounds like this beautiful utopic world where everyone works together beautifully, but then it's just the nature of the job. And if the company is aligned to that goal of user centricity, then I've seen that trickle down into your day-to-day interactions. Okay. As these different stakeholders, even in a small project.
Do the researchers sit with them during ideations? Do they sit with them all throughout the design process? Do they work in tandem all the time? Or is it more like the researchers, the process is more, first the researchers research about the project, then the research goes on to the design team. They then perceive the information and then start to work. And then again, it goes back. So is that how it works? Or are you like, is the design team like consistently working with a designer and a researcher at all times till the end of the project?
So that really depends on, how big is the design and the research team? Like, do you have enough researchers to contribute to a single project and be embedded from the start to the end? Or do you just have one who's like, they're very thinly stretched and doing different projects which are happening in the company. So there are these huge organizations which have a researcher per team, like say, let's say this squad of designers, managers and engineers and researchers are working on this feature. They will solely work on it from the start to the end. And there are sometimes in newer startups where there is only one or two researchers overlooking a lot of features, a lot of projects. So at that point of time, you cannot have this person embedded always, but there is a way in which, you know, design or the team can approach the research and say, you know what, this is the place we are stuck when we need answers. And, you know, this is priority one because of certain, certain impacts it will have in the organization, or OKR is a new term that we know. Because of that, that's when projects get prioritized with, say, among one or two researchers. Otherwise, you have a full-time researcher working with you in a feature. Now, the goal of research, if I have to speak a little bit more, is we help the team define the problem. Now, when I say define the problem, like what we said, we try to understand what are the users doing in the first place. We're trying to understand who are these users and does this problem really exist that you literally have assumptions in your mind about. And then that sort of problem definition, problem statement is given to the team to work on. So you have your entire team strategically planning how will they solve for this problem. You have design coming in and, you know, using the ideations. Now, when these ideations and concept explorations, as we call it, start happening, that's when design can be like, okay, before I proceed, I want to know whether this concept is going to be strong. Is it going to work with the users? That's when, again, the researcher jumps in and is like, you know, okay, fine, let's test it out. We need to test whether it's actually solving the user's need or not. Once we test these concepts, that's when people go in this whole iterative sort of design process. They keep building, they keep making, there are changes. And it's up to the designer and the team as to, you know, how much do they certainly know that this will work because of certain evidences that have come up in the past. Or are they still unclear about this? If they are still unclear, the researcher should jump in or the team should come and say that, no, we are still unclear. We need to do more tests. That's when your usability testing happens. So you continuously keep meeting users, keep showing them designs. You go from low fidelity mocks to like high-end prototypes and you show it to them and you get feedback. And it's more like, it's a loop, right? You get feedback, you change, you go back again, get more feedback, again change. That's what Meenakshi was talking about. It's a continuous loop that happens till your product is in this, you know, in this MVP stage where it's like, okay, fine, this looks good enough to launch at least internally, to launch at least to this percent of audience or this percent of users that we were targeting, just to check how it goes. But that doesn't mean that research is somewhere lost at that point of time, because, you know, it's launching out to users. Research still plays a part, because after it's launched, it will still come back and say, okay, let's talk to the people who it's launched to. Let's get more feedback. See how it's actually performing in the real world, not in a lab, not in some, you know, context that we've built up. We need to see how people are doing it. And then we also collaborate with other forms of research. You have data analysts, you have trend analysts. You have people who are, you have quant researchers, quantitative researchers who are looking at numbers, and they're coming back to you, and you know you're, they're showing you numbers of, you know, the usage going up or down, and then you're trying, as a qualitative researcher that me and Meenakshi are, we go and dive deep to understand, okay, now why are these numbers showing so? What is the reason behind this? So the research in a whole just pops up every single time where we or they see uncertainty. So that's how it looks. So we define the problem and we are always there in the refining of solutions.
Pratyush, how you were describing it, it seems very linear. How I would say is the product development might be linear initially. But say, for instance, you have had a product out there, a digital product out there for 10 years, maybe. And then you build, you're building smaller and smaller features within it, smaller and smaller improvements. This cycle happens for every single thing, but the involvement of research, when it happens, when design just takes the lead and runs with it, it's not always exactly the same, and it's not always structured the same. So like she said, there's ruthless prioritization of resources, and research, design, engineering, all of these are resources that you have to plan out and then execute, because you can't just be trying to hit every single phase with a certain amount of research, certain amount of design, because sometimes, say, it's Pride Month and then you have to release some sort of update then, or say, for instance, you have a huge launch coming up of something, you have to quickly wrap up the design for it and then maybe go back and do some testing. Very often that happens. Ideally, it's like how you describe, research happens at every stage before you go ahead and build things. But yeah, the resources are limited, so you have to plan accordingly. And in reality, it ends up becoming a little bit of a back and forth. Sometimes research is involved, sometimes design is involved, that kind of a process. And then things go out in the world like that. And as we speak, companies are trying to improve this process of involving these different kinds of professionals so that we make it more and more efficient to deliver these useful experiences for people. So we're part of that. Sometimes we have retrospective meetings where we're like, okay, last time we did it this way, it didn't work. Let's try and do this earlier. Let's try and answer some questions before we go in and build the whole thing, you know, things like that. And that's how we all collectively improve.
Bring that into practice? Is there some tools or is there some sort of checklist that holds you accountable throughout the process to make sure that in reality you continue to remain user-centric throughout the process?
Yeah, I think one thing is hire researchers. Why I say this, hire researchers, do research, or have a culture of trying to understand your user's point of view, is because only when you are aware that you don't know about your users at all, you are not your users, you don't know exactly how they work or what drives them to do certain things, till you accept it and you accept that you want to learn about it and that culture is not a part of your team or your organization, it's very difficult to keep putting the user in the center of your process while you're building things, while you're, you know, shipping features for a product, things like that. So having that culture and mindset is the most important thing. And then to be able to execute and build on that is when you try and do research or try and hire experts who are researchers, who can be the people who are most in touch with your users, and then they can be the advocates for them, be the people who bring up that user point of view in every point of decision making so that they can influence your product in that direction at every stage. But we know that that's not all companies don't have the kind of budget to hire experts for every single thing, and especially research ends up being one of those places where they don't end up in investing initially. Say if you're a startup, in that case, there are other ways that you can try and build this or act on this culture of trying to understand your users. And you have to use different sources of information that you have. So Pratyush, earlier you had mentioned a lot of secondary research. Other people may have studied what you are trying to understand in some form. That's a good way, good place to start. And this is something that used to happen at Swiggy, where you go sit with the people speaking to the customers. There's, hundreds of people on call every day with customers, and they can tell you what people really are feeling, what people are really experiencing. So those kind of sources of information help you empathize at least in some way, shape or form with your users, and then you bring that kind of knowledge, that kind of awareness back to the work that you do within the product development, and that can help you bring this, you know, this focus or make users the core of your process in actuality, instead of, you know, very often in design you're like, oh, you know, you draw the person in the center and you write all of their needs and this and that, and that's like, that's how it's user centric. But these little tiny nuggets of information, little tiny decisions, conversations, bringing user point of views, in reality how this happens even in companies that hire researchers in the first place. Yeah, I think, maybe Sidel has some stuff to add here.
Yeah, I think Meenakshi spoke a lot about building that culture where people prioritize and understand the value of research. Many times, companies don't have that culture, or many times there is a single researcher handling so much that, you know, she's a little lost in all of this, the projects that they have. So during this process, what I would suggest is we need to make sure that the team that you're working with at least have that collaborative, transparent attitude, so that your stakeholders, your team can come and witness firsthand what the users are saying. Because it's just like Chinese whispers, you know, once people see, they will go and tell someone else, you know, this user said this about this feature and we really need to change it. And someone else will be like, okay, I have a project where I need to see some what users are saying. So let's go and talk to this researcher who can do this job for me. So always try, right from kicking off your project, like understanding what your designer, what your engineer, or what your product manager wants to know from this research. Put them in and, you know, bring them together in one room from that point of time. When you're doing the research, make sure that they're taking notes. We always, me and Meenakshi always make our designers take notes. Because that's the way they're going to be involved. Or make them watch videos at some point of time. Schedule some time on the calendar right now where people can come and watch these one-on-one user videos. Or, you know, and these can't be like hour-long of videos where you've conducted the research 1 hour. You can actually create highlight clips of these. Make like 5 minutes, 2 minutes videos and show it to people. You know, this was like the most crucial line of this interview, and you want people to know what the users have said, and that can be something that you want to socialize with your entire team. That can be a great way of at least starting off this conversation of, you know, who are our users, what do they want. Something that me and Meenakshi did at Swiggy was we didn't go with the usual way of doing showing our research report, where we showed like this deck and presentation. We actually set up a room, and what we saw is that people who are not involved in the research, just because we were setting up this physical room of post-its and colored, you know, posters and photos, people just came in, walked in the room, and were like, you know, what are you doing? What is this about? And what did you learn? So that sparks a lot of conversation about your research in general. You can make research known, but you can also make the users known. So that's the way you can build in that culture in your organization where people are curious about research. So sometimes there are no researchers in the organization. So at that point of time, who is the voice of the user? So find people who are talking to users. One thing Meenakshi mentioned is going and talking to the customer care executives. You can also do this where you're talking to, you're seeing reviews and feedbacks on app stores, or you can go and see reviews and feedbacks on Twitter. Many bigger companies also have this user voice forum where people keep writing feedback about something or the other, or surveys. You can go and get that data and actually see what is the trends look like, you know, what are the patterns that are repeatedly coming up in your experience, and try and solve that. So there are many other ways to get this user voice, one has to just go and find it at who's getting them in their organization. It can be a data scientist, it can be a customer care executive, it can be a researcher, or you yourself can do an empathy exercise. Go, like if you are working in a food delivery company, go and enroll as a delivery executive and deliver some food one day, and you will get to know how, what are the challenges like when you're delivering food, say on a rainy day, and you can't see the app, and there's a lot of problems that come in at that point of time. So short empathy exercise is also helping building that voice. So you need to find your own creative way of bringing the users back again and again when you're having these conversations.
Have you managed to find that kind of an atmosphere through research as well?
I think I had anticipated missing this, or I had thought that when I switch to research, maybe I'll miss design. But I, personally for me, I chose research because even as a designer, I focus purely on the research, and very often I was sitting with my pen and paper or at the laptop thinking, but then why? Why am I doing this? And the great part of working for digital products is one of the key partners that I have when I'm doing my work is design. So you're constantly in that world, you're seeing prototypes being made, you're conducting workshops with designers, or you're participating in that kind of activity. And that general energy of creating and being around innovation and that kind of thought process, ideas, that is what charges you up as a creative person or someone who was a designer. So I think that fulfills it a little bit. But it's, even as a researcher, it's it doesn't seem, if you look at it on its surface, it doesn't seem like, oh, why would you need creativity to be a researcher? You're just finding out information. But there are various forms that creativity takes. And I think as designers who are now out in the industry, both of you might also notice that it's not all about the sketching. It's not all about the 3D work that you do or prototype building. There's a thought process that you have as a designer that is unique. And you can bring that to everything that you do, including research. So like what Sidel and I do very often, we try to discuss ways of communicating ourselves and what we're doing today, or what we do when we would finish a project. We are not just trying to put a present, very, you know, if you have just data or information or insights, you could very well just put it in a document and just send it to people, done, everyone knows it. But we understand the people who are trying to consume our information. So we always joke about this, where we say that we build our research reports for our users, who are our stakeholders or the people involved in our project. And we have to do it in a way that it helps them do their work. So if I'm presenting to a designer, I need to give them insights that inspire their design, insights that inform their design, and not just dump information on them. And that's where creative thinking, creative execution of, you know, say visualizing how you're communicating it, or how do you put the designer in the point of view of the user? So the kind of things that Sidel was speaking about earlier, where we've set up a room where we invite people into it, it puts you in a different way, in a different context, and it helps you think differently or communicate or connect with the user more. And that's what we would try to do. And that was, again, a creative process, because we're trying to think about, oh, how do I show this? How do I tell this user story in a way that really, really connects with people? And that's where those elements of creativity are involved. Even if it's as simple as, okay, I'm going to do 6 user interviews for this research. What questions will you ask? What questions will inspire certain kinds of answers? Because if you're wanting people to visualize their ideas for you, how do you do that? Do you just ask them to speak about it? Do you ask them to maybe scribble a little thing on paper? Do you do an exercise with them? All of those kind of things also require a certain level of creativity. So it's, I think
doing research has changed my point of view towards design and what I think design thinking really is, and understand how I'm still designing things as a researcher. I am still being creative as a researcher, and that I think is true about any profession, but these are some ways that I personally see myself, you know, fulfilling that, oh, this is how my background influences how I do things as a researcher.
After both of y'all started studying design research and now it's been years, do you feel like it's changed your perspective just in general, not only within design, but you because you use empathy, you understand people, your job is to understand users, but then do you feel like in your daily life also it has informed your day-to-day interactions with individuals?
I think the power of, not power, but the power, okay, let's use power, of reasoning or questioning has improved a lot being a researcher. I think that is something I didn't see myself doing for a long time. Let's talk on college. You never reason, you never question what were you building or why are you seeing certain, why is this bottle the way it is. So after being a researcher, that has improved a lot. You're trying to question, you're trying to understand, and if there are no answers, you're trying to bridge the gap. So I feel that has improved. Apart from that, it just that, you know, when you do your first research project and you just get your first project and you think like, you know, what new can come out of this? We're showing some designs, it looks perfect. But when you talk to a user and when they are struggling to find that one pay now button to complete their task, and it's just there in a different color, they cannot like see it, or maybe it's not intuitive enough, maybe that color, maybe they have some problems. So that really opens your eye and says that, you know, it can be anything perfect. It can be something that you've used all your design knowledge into, but it's still not perfect to your users because it's still not matching their needs. So that is something I learned, that no matter what you do and how much time you spend on it and how perfect it looks, you need to go and show it to your users. So you need to question what's been made. Second is you need to validate what has been made. And that is a big learning, and you only see it once you research. If you've not researched, you won't understand the power of what it brings to the table. That is something that I feel that after going into research, after learning research and doing it for so many years, our perspective has been changing about how people will react to it, how, you know, people from different cultures and different backgrounds can react to it. Because, you know, you might show, say, build the best of apps and go and test it in rural India, they are not going to get it. They are not going to get what's a share button. They are not going to get what does sharing even mean. So that is something that, you know, it opens your, everything that you do, and the moment you be more inclusive and you call more people from different socioeconomic stratas, different cultures, different backgrounds, maybe different age groups, then you gather more and more insights of how this is not working out to a larger audience.
Minakshi,
how this is only working to a niche that people who maybe you just imagine yourself using in the first place. So
for you,
I think research is a big eye-opener when you think
and
about it.
Inclusion.
Like,
yeah, and in the past, you both have worked at a food delivery company. So doing these different types of projects, how much do you think the tools you use or the framework or the process that you use changes from industry to industry? Or how do you even adapt your mindset to take these different roles? Or does it even drastically change, or is it more or less the same?
I think, so of course the kind of industry that you're working in, the kind of company that you're working in, the access to tools is very different. So you know, when Sidel and I were working earlier, maybe we had a certain kind of tool that was available to us, but now we have something else. Maybe we have better tools to try and, say, find the right people or speak to people remotely without, you know, it becoming a problem or being a barrier in communication, things like that. But
what really affects how you approach a certain project is many different things. One thing is what kind of method of research you're trying to do.
Right.
So when we were at Swiggy, for instance, we used to travel across India to speak to people purely because it was not the norm to do everything digitally. We were speaking to people from different kinds of cities. So not just metros, but also tier 2, tier 3 cities in India. We wanted to really be there with people to understand how they've been using the application, what their experience is like. Or we used to go to restaurants, actually physically sit in the kitchen or a space where you can see the workings of the restaurant to physically be able to track how one package goes from the kitchen to like the prep table to the bag, which is taped with that Swiggy tape and sent out the door. So we used to do, so you can see that there's two different things. If you're having a conversation with a person, the kind of tools that you're using is, okay, I need to plan, I need to find the right person, I need to have a space which is comfortable, where they can be open, where they don't feel like they're being judged, or they can be very honest about what they think about the application, things like that. You might be thinking about how do you go ahead and process this information? You've recorded the conversation. Have you written handwritten notes? Sometimes one of them is possible. Sometimes it's not. So depending on these kind of things, the way that you are going to plan it out, the kind of tools that you're using, all of that completely changes. And now if you take like the flip side, what kind of research mm-hmm. we do today, a lot of it might be remote. So we need to account for informing people how to join us in a video call, mm-hmm. Making them comfortable, asking them permission to be able to record things, asking them for their permission to, you know, giving them that comfort zone of, it's okay if the background is messy, it's okay if a little bit of your house is showing, you know, you're trying to make them comfortable in a completely different setup with different tools. So that is majorly a thing that affects the kind of tools that you will use, apart from the access that you have to these. And I think another thing is just preference. Like Sidel and I used to be these hardcore, like notebook, post-its, everything physical kind of people. Of course, you can tell that now that's not really possible. So we found a quick switch where we do digital whiteboards and things like that. We are collaborating using Excel sheets. Some people might want to use some other tool entirely. Maybe they like to use Notion to do the same thing, or maybe they like to use the sticky notes digitally on their desktop and then just populate it. So the style mm-hmm. also matters. So I think tools get affected by the approach and the thought process, and the industry also influences the way that you go communicate with people, the way that you, the kind of research methods that you even adopt or can adopt, given the nature of the products, given the nature of the industry. I think all of those things are affecting how we go about executing the research.
Yeah, because the tools are really, it depends on the organization, like Meenakshi said, but mostly for research, it's like the method really matters. For completing that, that's the most important thing. You can use any tool, and the tools keep on changing based on the method that you're using. But the first important thing to get right is the method. And how do you get to the method is you need to define what are you trying to look for, or what are you trying to find out first. Mm-hmm. So are you trying to solve a usability issue? Are you testing some designs? Are you thinking about adding some new features or looking for new opportunities? These are the questions that will come up when you're talking to people in your organization. And based on these questions, there are different methods to help you out with it. There are, you know, you do usability testing, you have surveys, you have things like doing testing two different types of design. That's called A/B testing. Or diary studies, where, you know, you're testing for a period of time, say 6 months, 1 year, you want to try to see how user behavior changes. Those are very longitudinal. And all of these methodologies are really old. They're set, they're tried, people have used it, and, you know, they're set in stone. But it depends on the researcher how much they want to modify it, how much they want to be creative within it. and also the kind of people you're talking to. Like, you cannot do a usability testing with a XD prototype or a Figma prototype with someone who is visually impaired, because simple thing, your voiceover and screen readers won't work on it. You can use it. Had there been a temporary or a partial disability, let's say if the person is, they need to use only screen magnifiers because they can't see certain things clearly. So that way you can use a prototype. But if they purely use some screen recorders, these prototypes don't work. But you need to then reach out to engineering. Mm-hmm. Reach out to people who can code that prototype for you. Make it in a such a way that, you know, the screen readers work on it so that you can test it with people with disabilities or people or differently abled people. So that's how your approaches or your tools change all the time, thinking about the people you're going to talk to. Like, let's say I have to test something on a phone and, you know, it's an app and it's an iPhone that I used to take for testing in Bangalore. It's fine. But I can't take the same iPhone and go to somewhere in a small rural area because A, people will look at it and get nervous. They will not even touch it to use the phone. And B, they are not used to using high-end phones. They will not be used to even using a Samsung. That's when you choose that, you know, let's go to some other model. Let's go to models that they use. Those are the things that you need to be aware and mindful of before going and meeting those people. So for accessibility, you need to know what assistive technologies they have. For people like, say, different socioeconomic strata, you need to know the language they speak in, the language they're comfortable in, the technology they use. That way you modify your method. Then simply, like, if you're talking about some taboo topics, like I did research very long back on sexual reproductive health in Rajasthan. Very taboo topic to talk that also in Rajasthan with women. And for them, we literally didn't call them to a fancy place, you know, let's come and talk to us, tell us about your health. We actually created safe spaces in clinics they visit. We created safe spaces to say the nurses they talk to, they're called ASHA workers. We always had, apart from us, we had people who they are familiar with, like a doctor they're familiar with, a nurse they're familiar with, so that they can open up to you and talk to you about very, very, very personal information about their reproductive health, their sexual health, their knowledge about it. So these things, the methodology stays the same. I'm still conducting an interview, but where am I conducting it? How am I conducting? How am I looking? Like, I cannot go in jeans to these safe spaces. I have to wear a kurta and go because they would judge me right from the first sight. So that is why these things you need to be mindful of. Keep the methodologies the same. Change the approach every time you go to, you know, meeting different people every single time.
When do you stop researching? There is so much to learn about every subject.
That's true. Yeah, I think Sidhel and I would agree to this, that every day we're like, oh my god, this should have been research, why aren't we doing this, you know? It'll never be enough. One thing is that whenever you're starting a research study, you start asking what you need to answer through the study, and that really helps you scope what you can find from that methodology. For instance, if you're trying to find, if you're trying to understand, say, how are people using images as a part of their work, which was one of the studies I did recently, it's not going to be enough to, say, speak for 20 minutes to 5-6 people and then call it a day. We already know that. We know that this is a very big question. But then we dig into, what do we really want to know? Do we want to know how they use images? Do we want to know how they use screenshots, scans? Because images can be many different things. So you try to align all the people who are trying to ask these questions, all your stakeholders, all the people designing, building the application. You come together to answer these few, what do we already know, first of all? That's very important. That's how we try to cut, you know, not reinvent the wheel every time and make sure that you're prioritizing. What do we assume and what assumptions have our current work been based on? What data do we have access to already? What has not worked in the past, which we're kind of trying out again this time? Why are we doing that? So getting these conversations done, getting these points of views in place helps the researchers really scope the research and reframe what we are trying to understand. So you come up with, say, five key things that your key goals that your research has. Like you're trying to understand how people do certain tasks. You're trying to understand this is a specific context you're trying to understand. You try and define who would be exactly the right people to speak to get this information and these answers. And that planning and that scoping of the research is what helps you really hit the target. Because like you said, everything has a deadline. When you have to put a product out there, you have to work on a deadline, otherwise it'll never happen. So given that that's the case, given that you still want to research, this is how you ruthlessly prioritize what you want to know. You design your research in a way that you get these answers. And what I tend to do at the end of the research also is reflect back and see, this is what we were trying to answer, this is what we did answer, and these are still questions which are unanswered, or still details within the questions that we still don't know, or I can't claim that this research has answered today. And that can then become the scope for the next thing that you do. And you're always going to keep researching. It's better to keep doing it more and more rather than thinking that you want all the answers all at once right now and then getting stuck doing like a 1 year study with no end, because the product has already moved past. Your research that you started at the beginning of the year is already too old to inform the product. So that's why you have to have these conversations at the right time with the right people, and it helps you then not get into that loop of, but I want to know everything. And I think that has really been a personal learning for me. I used to very often get into a conversation with people and be like, oh yeah, then tell me about, you know, you using GIFs at work and also videos at work, and tell me about Word files, etc., etc. And it can go out of hand that way. So researchers have to really focus on the goal, design the research for the goal, and then at the end still see what's unanswered and maybe put that in the goal for the next time.
But I think one way of, you know, prioritizing these questions that come through, get thrown at you every single time, is you need to always see that will answering that question at this point of time have a certain outcome or an output or say an impact in the team. If that is not what the organization or your team is focused on doing for this quarter, this year, this month, then there is no point focusing on that right now. We can maybe keep a hold of it, focus on it the next time, because that's when the team or, you know, a set of designers can take it up and solve that challenge. And think about the critical aspects right now which need to be answered, like something that we call P0, like, you know, we call it the red flag thing for us. So that is something that we always have to keep prioritizing and keep getting answers to. And during your research, like Meenakshi said, you'll always come across new use cases, new problems that you're like, oh, this is a problem I didn't think about. This is the problem the team wasn't thinking about. Maybe we need to validate it a bit more. But then again, you need to go back to your team and say, do we really need to think about this right now? Is it really something that's going to contribute to that first launch that's going to happen somewhere in March, April, wherever? If it's not, then maybe you can think about it after that. So there's always, like, you know, something that you have to prioritize based on the organization and needs at the moment. What is the goal that you're trying to set? If the goal is engagement, or, you know, if the goal is creating a satisfied user experience, there is no point thinking about, you know, how do we retain people? How do we upsell people? There's no point thinking about that. That can be something that is a secondary goal for us. And that's again, where you require research the second time.
This is the end of part one. Tune in to part two, where we discuss about the changing nature of mobile productivity tools, the office shifting to an online space, and lots more. If you liked the video, hit the thumbs up and subscribe for more. You can also find the Design Over Breakfast podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. For now, thank you for listening, and see you next time.